day. It wasn't until later that night, as she lay down on her narrow bed, that she realized she was planning murder. The realization troubled her. Briefly. She closed her eyes and told herself that Archbishop Overmeyer had been perfectly willing to sacrifice her in order to deal with Stoner. Well, she would help the Archbishop become a holy martyr. God's will be done, she told herself, just before she lapsed into a tranquil sleep, undisturbed by troubling dreams. It was at the annual Founders Day banquet that the crucial piece of Angelique's plan fell into place. The banquet was held in Washington, D.C., as usual, in the ornate old rock pile of a building that had once housed the National Museum of Natural History. Now it was a combination of religious, shrine, visitor's center, and recruitment station for the New Morality, Inc. In the grand, high-roofed entrance lobby, where exhibits of elephants and extinct mastodons had awed visitors in the past, Angelique looked out upon a sea of dining tables, each covered with spanking white tablecloths and gleaming disposable dinnerware. Men in tuxedos and women in bejeweled evening gowns were streaming in for an evening of good food and self-congratulatory speeches. Angelique, who had lived under her vow of poverty all her adult life, wrinkled her nose at them. The crowd looked to her like a mix of penguins and peacocks. As Archbishop Overmeyer and his retinue of bishops, minus Bishop Craig, who was in Jakarta, marched in hierarchical order to their seats at the head table, followed by dignitaries led by the President of the United States, the final pieces of the idea finally clicked in Angelique's head. Impatiently, she sat at her assigned table far off to the right of the speakers. She could hardly wait for the long evening to draw to its droning conclusion. She noted that Archbishop Overmeyer had regained the few pounds he had lost in the hospital, and then some. Despite the most inventive tailoring of his dark clerical suit, he still looked like a bloated black whale. At last, the final cliché had been uttered, the last standing ovation given, and the assembled diners began to file out of the hall, buzzing with muted conversations. A collection of the biggest donors was lining up to shake hands with the President and the Archbishop, of course. It wasn't enough for most people to see and listen to the great and famous. They still had the Simeon's urge to touch the Alphas. It was approaching midnight when the Archbishop finally broke free and headed for the elevator that would whisk him to his private apartment on the former museum's top floor, accompanied by a small phalanx of assistants and security guards. Angelique fell in with the cluster of dark-suited men. One of the security guards eyed her questioningly when she squeezed into the elevator, but his chief recognized her with a nod and a smile. Once they reached the unmarked double doors of his apartment, the Archbishop turned to the small group of men with a weary smile. "I thank you all, and hope you enjoyed the banquet." Lots of nodding and murmured agreement. "It's been a long evening. I'm very tired." He pulled a white silk handkerchief from his jacket and mopped his brow. More murmurs, and the group moved away, drifting back toward the elevator. The Archbishop opened his door. Angelique followed him into the apartment's sitting room and closed the door behind her. The Archbishop turned toward her with a slight frown on his jowly face. "I won't need any assistance, thank you, sister."
"Your Eminence, I must speak with you for a few minutes."
"I really am very tired," he repeated with steel in his tone.
"It's about the Star Voyager," Angelique said hurriedly. "I know how to get rid of him."
Archbishop Overmeyer blinked at her several times. At last he sank into the nearest armchair and gestured for her to sit next to him. Without waiting for him to give her permission to speak, Angelique blurted,
"You must call for an international meeting of the world's religious and political leaders."
"Must I?" Overmeyer replied, his voice dripping acid.
"The Holy Apostles, the Light of Allah, the New Tao, and the Red Chrysanthemum," Angelique said eagerly. "And the heads of state for all the governments on earth."
"But why?"
"The reason for the meeting will be to discuss ways to ease international tensions and increase brotherhood across the world. Global food distribution, energy prices, climate stabilization, all the topics that contribute to international tensions."
Overmeyer's frown deepened. "Population growth?"
Population growth also, said Angelique with a nod. Of course.
But not family planning. We can't allow any discussions that might lead to contraception and abortion.
Certainly, Your Eminence, I understand.
An international conference, the Archbishop muttered, to ease global tensions. He allowed the beginnings of a smile to curve his heavy lips.
That will be the reason we give to the public. The actual reason will be to discuss how to get rid of the nuclear weapons.
Overmeyer's smile vanished. We'll discuss that in secret, I presume.
Of course, Angelique said. And as a gesture of good faith on our part, the new morality will induce the United States government to dismantle several of its nuclear weapons. As a demonstration, out in the desert where they've been built and stored.
Overmeyer rubbed his chins. And you think this will satisfy the Star Voyager? You think he'll leave, then?
No, Your Eminence. I think there will be a terrible accident. A tragic accident.
The Archbishop's narrow little eyes widened. An explosion?
A nuclear explosion. Not even Stoner could live through that.
That's a murder.
An execution, Your Eminence. An execution of an enemy. A threat to the new morality and all it stands for.
For several moments, the Archbishop sat in his armchair in silence. At last he objected.
But how could you arrange it so that Stoner is killed and no one else? He's no fool, you know.
Angelique bobbed her head in agreement.
There will have to be other casualties. We'll keep them down to a minimum, but there will have to be others caught in the blast with him. Martyrs, even though they won't know it beforehand.
The Archbishop folded his hands over his expansive belly.
I suppose you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, can you? He murmured.
No, you can't, Angelique said,
barely suppressing the elation that she felt inside her. The Archbishop held up his right hand.
Very well. I am very tired. It's been a long evening.
Angelique dutifully sank to her knees and bowed her head. Archbishop Overmeyer put his hand on her head and murmured a blessing. She knew he was blessing not only her, he was blessing her plan. Chapter 3. Despite a lifetime spent in scientific research and administration, Bertram Feingold had never been in space. He had admired the stunningly beautiful images of stars and nebulae captured by space-borne telescopes. He had thrilled at the discoveries of ancient villages on Mars. He had fought for better funding for the research stations orbiting the giant planet Jupiter and the hellhole of Venus. But he himself had never left Earth, not even for a stint aboard an orbiting space station, not even as a tourist exploring the wonders of Selene and the other settlements on the moon. Of course, space tourism was practically dead these days. You needed all sorts of government approvals to fly as far as one of the orbital hotels, because the new morality frowned on pleasure seekers who wanted to try sex in zero gravity. There were even more layers of red tape to cut through before you were allowed to go to the moon. Too many tourists never returned to Earth. Too many asked for political or religious asylum once they got to Selene, and received it. Every year, it seemed to Feingold, it became more difficult even for scientists to gain permission to leave Earth temporarily to do research in space. The new morality didn't like having its comfortable 12th-century view of the universe disturbed by new information, new knowledge, new facts. Feingold struggled hard to get those young, eager researchers to where their curiosity was pushing them. Sometimes he failed. But he counted his victories instead of his defeats. So it was with a great deal of personal satisfaction and not a little trepidation that Feingold embarked on his mission to asteroid 67-046 and his rendezvous with the alien artifact. His mission began with a liftoff aboard a cone-shaped clipper ship, which carried him to a space station orbiting Earth. Feingold had studied all he could find about the physical effects of weightlessness that one encountered in orbit. It wasn't actually zero gravity, he knew. The structure of the space vehicle and all the equipment in it exerted a minuscule gravitational force. The correct term was microgravity. But to normal human senses, there was no discernible difference.